That was the year.
Recreating notable events of passing time, reviving memories of men and women who have contributed to the history of a modern world.
That was the year.
London calling New York. Go ahead, please.
Hello. Hello, London. This is the New York American. Victor Watson talking.
These were the historic first words to be transmitted via commercial radio telephone across the Atlantic Ocean on January 7, 1927. Through equipment costing $5 millions, owned by the American Telephone and Telegraph Company and the British General Post Office. Messages, greetings, and news dispatches were carried more than 3,000 miles in 18/1,000ths of a second. The two news stories were printed in that afternoon's edition of the London Evening Standard with the footnote,
"These dispatches represent practically instantaneous transmission of news between Washington, New York, and London, a distance of approximately 3,200 miles.
1927. That was the year.
New York, April 7th. While an audience of about 60 persons, including newsmen, officials, and friends of the American Telephone and Telegraph Company, sit in rapt attention, gazing at a piece of new equipment featuring a rectangular aperture 2 by 2.5 inches, the AT&T's president, Walter S. Gifford, rises at about 2 o'clock and speaks.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're about to witness another milestone in the conquest of nature by science. We shall see in a moment or two the fruition of years of study on the problem of seeing at a distance as if face to face. I'm going to call General Carty, our vice president in Washington. Ready with Washington?
Ready, Mr. Gifford.
All right, switch it on. There. Hello, General.
Hello, Mr. Gifford. Can you see me?
Yes, and General, you look handsome.
You think the television flatters me?
Well, I think it's an improvement. Put Mr. Hoover on. There he is. Hello, Mr. Secretary.
Hello, Mr. Gifford.
You look very well.
Thank you.
Now, Mr. Secretary, will you address our audience here in New York?
It is a matter of just pride to have a part in this historic occasion. It promises that where the voice has led the way over the telephone wires, the eye will ultimately follow. Scientists for many years in many countries have struggled to solve the problems of television. We may all take pride that its actual accomplishment is brought about by American genius and its first demonstration staged in our own country.
For the first time in history, the scanning disc of television transmitted the physical features of a human face instantaneously from one place to another, miles away.
1927. That was the year.
Chicago, Illinois, January 22. While millions of Americans listened at their receiving sets, 20 microphones placed at advantageous spots throughout the stage of the Auditorium Theater picked up and sent out over wavelengths of 27 radio stations the second act of Gounod's grand opera, Faust. Another milestone.
1927. That was the year.
Roosevelt Field, New York, April 14. Remaining in the air 51 hours and 11 minutes, Bert Acosta and Clarence Chamberlain break the world's non-stop endurance flight record.
Roosevelt Field, May 20.
Well, if we ever get to Paris and cup that prize, they'll probably give us a pretty cold reception. Especially after those poor fellows, Nungesser and Coley, have been lost.
I wouldn't blame the French people for that. But it's all right with me. I don't like anyone to make a fuss over me.
Say, Slim, you talk as if you're sure of landing in Paris.
I am sure. I've got a return ticket on the steamer and an introduction to the ambassador, Herrick, in my pocket right now.
But Slim never used his return steamship ticket nor his letter of introduction to Myron T. Herrick. For Slim was Charles Augustus Lindbergh, who on that memorable dawn of May 20, 1927, taxied his monoplane Spirit of St. Louis across a sodden field to begin his 3,610-mile flight toward the capital of France to win the Raymond Ortega prize of $25,000. 33 hours, 29 minutes, and 30 seconds later, the Spirit of St. Louis circled the Eiffel Tower and settled cleanly amid a wildly ecstatic throng on Le Bourget flying field in Paris. And Charles Slim Lindbergh was carried by tearful, shouting countrymen of martyrs Nungesser and Coley to be welcomed by Ambassador Herrick, the President of France, and Louis Blériot, who 18 years before had been the first man to fly across the English Channel. Slim Lindbergh had no use for his introduction to Myron Herrick, for arrangements had already been made for his sojourn in the ambassador's home. He had no use for his return ticket on the steamer, for after meeting Crown Prince Leopold in Belgium and the Prince of Wales in London, he returned to his native land upon the warship Memphis, a guest of the U.S. government, the first man ever to be accorded that honor. In the nation's capital, he found himself a hero overnight, a hero in the eyes of school children, a hero in the eyes of businessmen and artisans, a hero in the eyes of statesmen, a hero in the eyes of housewives and shop girls, a hero in the eyes of a brave mother. After receiving the ovations of worshiping thousands, Slim Lindbergh heard these words from the lips of Calvin Coolidge.
As President of the United States, I bestow the Distinguished Flying Cross, a symbol of appreciation for what he is and what he has done, upon Colonel Charles A. Lindbergh.
On the evening of May 21st, I arrived at Le Bourget, France. I was in Paris for 1 week, in Belgium for a day, and was in London and England for several days. Everywhere I went, at every meeting I attended, I was requested to bring a message home to you. Always the message was the same. You have seen, the message was, the affections of the people of France for the people of America demonstrated to you. When you return to America, take back that message to the people of the United States, from the people of France and of Europe. I thank you.
June 4.
Clarence Chamberlain and Charles A. Levine take off from New York in their monoplane Columbia. Land the next day on a furrowed field near Eisleben, Germany.
June 28.
Lieutenants Lester Maitland and Albert Hagenberger take off from Oakland, California, to land 25 hours and 50 minutes later at Wheeler Field, Honolulu, Hawaii.
June 29.
Lieutenant Commander Richard E. Byrd with his crew of three, Novelle, Balkan, and Acosta, take off from New York to come down in the sea off Versailles, France. 43 hours, 21 minutes later.
1927, July 14.
Ernest Smith and Emery Bronte, after being wished well by Maitland and Hagenberger, take off in a plane christened City of Oakland for their port of departure and land the next day on the island of Molokai, Hawaii, on the tops of a clump of trees, their gasoline supply gone.
1927, August 17.
Arthur Goebel and William Davis set their plane down in Honolulu to win the James D. Dole nonstop flight to Hawaii prize of $25,000.
1927, August 27.
Airmen Brock and Schley take off from Harbor Grace, Newfoundland, to land 18 days later in Tokyo, Japan, flying via Europe and Asia.
1927, October 10.
French flyers Costa and Labrie lift their huge ship named in honor of their martyred compatriots Nungesser and Coley to begin their memorable round-the-world flight. 6 months later to the day, they landed again in their home city, Paris, France.
1927, television, transatlantic telephone, transoceanic airplane flights, round-the-world air flight. 1927, truly a year of milestones of the air.
1927, that was the year
that Bartolomeo Vanzetti and Nicola Sacco were executed to satisfy their conviction for the murder of a Massachusetts shoe factory paymaster and his guard. A conviction that had stirred up a tempest of liberal vituperation the world over.
That was the year
that a 3-minute earthquake in the vicinity of Tokyo, Japan, hurtled 2,000 persons to their graves, injured more than 41,000.
That was the year
that 17-year-old George Young of Toronto, Canada, swam the 22 miles between Santa Catalina Island and the mainland of California in less than 16 hours, winning a $25,000 prize offered by the Chicle tycoon, William Wrigley Jr.
And that was the year,
Chicago, September 22. Before a crowd of 150,000 who had paid more than $2.5 million, Gene Tunney retained his heavyweight boxing championship, defeating former champion Jack Dempsey in a 10-round decision. During the seventh round, Dempsey knocked Tunney to the floor, consumed four precious seconds getting into a neutral corner designated by referee Beeler. Allowing the champion a much-needed rest for the count of nine, Dempsey later made his famous claim of a long count. And during a radio broadcast of the event by Graham McNamee, 11 persons died of heart failure. One swallowed a toothpick.
1927, that was the year.
Rapid City, South Dakota, in an office of the high school, sits the nation's chief executive, Calvin Coolidge, surrounded by his personal staff and newsmen. The president had promised the journalists an important statement. And shortly after noon, as Mr. Coolidge gazed round the room...
Is everyone here?
Yes, we're all here, Mr. President.
Mr. Sanders, lock the door. If the members of the conference will file past, I will hand this announcement to each one.
Silently, they received slips of paper about an inch wide. And as they read the message, there began a wild scramble for the door. For the president's succinct message was...
I do not choose to run for president in 1928.
1927. That was the year...
That this popular ballad first appeared to stir the hearts of two continents.
Thank you.